se lo ritengo.
Ok.
We're gonna have Israelites today, kids. You thought I didn't know anything about machinery. Okay, I'm not quite ready for this yet. Put your maybe your thing down so I can see your baby blues.
Baby brown.
Baby brown.
Kill me, Lord. I do, Lord, just come to you in a prayer, thanking you for many blessings that you give to us every day. You know, the same God, this past time, the truth, the answer, the sound of your progress. Help us to be able to explain to the God.
We're looking at the image of the four metals, the feet of iron, the legs, the legs of iron, the feet and toes of iron mixed with clay, the stone cut out, not with hands, comes down, strikes the image, destroys it. The stone becomes a great mountain and fills the earth. Are you with me? Now, we're looking at that's the key element in it. There's not, among conservative scholars, there is no real debate as to what the head means, the arms and chest, the torso, and the legs of iron. The problem comes in with the feet of iron and clay. Let me explain briefly. You already understand this, I think. I on top of page 13 in your syllabus, I diagram the alternatives. Now, the basic question, before I get into this, the question is not whether the feet and legs are wrong. The question is whether or not it represents historic Rome. Now, the reason that question emerges, which is, in my opinion, a phony baloney question, exegetically speaking, is because the pivotal question is whether or not the church is the Messianic kingdom. Now, just get that in your mind. That's one of the critical issues in prophecy, and especially the book of Daniel. Is the church or is it not the Messianic kingdom? Not the kingdom in some sense, but the Messianic kingdom. This stone which was cut out not with hands, destroys the image, and becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. If the church is the Messianic kingdom, then there's no problem. You don't have to separate the toes from the feet. If the church is not the Messianic kingdom, then you do. Remember, I quoted Hal Lindsey that the ten toes, presumably ten, are the divine Roman Empire. Now look at the diagram off page 13 very quickly. Here are the four basic interpretations. If the feet and toes are historic Rome, the Messianic kingdom is the church, the destruction is historic destruction of pagan Rome by the influence of the gospel. Now, let me point out, Gibbon blamed the fall of Rome on the church. He was right. The book of Revelation makes it very clear. What's the book of Revelation about? The book of Revelation is about this. That Rome has suddenly become threatened by the church. And Rome has realized that the church is a threat to the Roman Empire because the political myth that is holding the Roman Empire together, the glue which keeps this cracked, frail thing intact, is the myth of the deity of Caesar, Caesar worship, the absolute authority of Caesar, holding it together, and that absolute authority is based on the concept that Caesar is Lord. Caesar is a god, or represents a god. The church said, no, Jesus is Lord. And the church, in that sense, and so the book of Revelation talks about this great struggle to the death between the gospel and classic and ancient state paganism. State paganism is the phrase I want to use. Because philosophically, and that's the foundation of all things, one must destroy the other because both cannot stand together. And the book of Revelation is about this great struggle between historic Rome and the church. And it says, the church is going to win. That's why it was written in apocalyptic language. Rome would not appreciate it at all, they came out and said. But Rome's going to be about the church, and Rome's going to, in a few years, three generations from now, Rome's going to be gone, the church still be here. Now, the plan worked out that way, in case you haven't noticed, Rome is gone, and we're here. Now, you understand? So that concept is a biblical concept, the destruction. And in what sense does the church destroy the whole image? The answer is that the genius of the ancient Oriental empires was incorporated into the Roman Empire. In that sense, that is, when Rome fell, that was the end of the ancient Oriental worldview. That was the end of that way of doing business. And that's the view that I teach. Why? I think it's consistent with the total teaching of Scripture on the subject. And, listen to me, if, as a matter of fact, is there not a time element? We're going to see this again and again. Is there not a time element in the prophecy? There's going to be at least not a precise time element, but a time element. There's going to be four empires in the days of the fourth empire. God's going to set up his kingdom, which in contrast to these shall be destroyed. His kingdom shall never be destroyed. Yeah, there's a time element. But if there, as a matter of fact, there's a huge 2,000 year gap at least between the feet and the toes. But the feet, the heel bone, the ankle bone, whatever, that's the historic Roman Empire. But the toes are the revived Roman Empire. And the stone is going to strike the toe because the church is not the kingdom. Then it destroys, in my opinion, the essential character of the prophecy. It stops being a time prophecy and becomes an absurd. Now, but we're going to come back to this all through the day. I'm going to repeat myself. That's one of the fundamental issues in eschatology. Is the church the kingdom or not? Now, the second. Now, look down. I'm not going to go over this. But I put this parenthetical study in for your reference. Is the church the messianic kingdom? What does the New Testament say? Well, you can study that. And I put that in there because we don't have time to go into it. This is because it's not an eschatology course. You understand that? So I teach that the church is the messianic kingdom. When Jesus said, announced his kingdom, when Jesus said, and John the Baptist said, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom is here. I think they meant that. I think it was the time was fulfilled and the kingdom was there. At hand, he said. Not hand, meant at hand. Got that? Now, the second interpretation, I don't mind the word basic because there are versions of all these, is that the feet and toes are the revived Roman Empire. The messianic kingdom is the church, and the destruction of the image is the second coming. That is, the church exists, but the church doesn't destroy the image until Jesus returns. And the church and the revival. How many hold that view? That's kind of a hybrid view. The third view is the feet and toes are the revived Roman Empire. The church is the millennial reign of Jesus on earth. The destruction of the second coming. That is, the church is not the kingdom. The church is a parenthetical mystery. This is Bowder and Dallas Theological Seminary and Hal Lindsey. Or TV preachers. That the church is not the kingdom, and that the Roman Empire will be revived at the end of the age, this age, and that the stone striking the feet of the image is the second coming.
And then the millennial kingdom is established. The stone becomes a great mountain filled with oil. Now, I don't teach that because I teach the church of the kingdom. The second, the last view is that the 10, the feet and toes, are a consecutive kingdom as extensions of the historic Roman Empire, now through history. Understand? 10 consecutive, not contemporary, but consecutive. And then the destruction image is the progressive destruction of the extended Roman Empire, culminating in the second coming. Well, those are the alternatives. You understand the nature of the question?
In these consecutive kingdoms and extensions, would that be like the world powers that have seen since?
Well, they would go down like to the Holy Roman Empire, the British Empire, and all that. I don't know how to explain that. The two major views are A and C. Two kingdoms, as far as number of people hold. C is becoming an increasingly popular view. A is the dominant scholarly view. Well, okay. Any questions on that? We come now verses 46-49 to end chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar honors Daniel and his God. Then, so Daniel tells him what he saw, and also tells him what it means. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, did homage to Daniel, and gave order to present him an offering of fragrant incense. King answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel and made him gave him great gifts, many great gifts. He became a very wealthy man. Daniel probably became one of the wealthiest men in the world at this time. Babylon was the wealthiest kingdom. He made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Kind of vice president. Then Daniel made a request to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So they were also elevated with him. They became the top echelon, top advisory council, so leading bureaucrats. Okay. Now, the liberal critics say this is not believable, not credible, because Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan and he would not pay that kind of homage to Daniel's God in any case. That will not hold up because he does not say, note this, he did not become a monotheist. Nebuchadnezzar did not say Daniel's God is the only God that exists. He's simply saying Daniel's God did what the other gods couldn't do or didn't do. And he simply paid homage to Daniel's God. Mark pointed out something, a discrepancy in something I said in the dates. Mark, would you point that out to us? He caught this, and I really need to remind us to leave it correctly.
In chapter 1, verse 19, you said when Daniel entered the king's personal service, you said it was about 601 B.C. In chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar was given the dream, he said it was 603 B.C.
Yeah. So the discrepancy is that his what?
He had Daniel interpreted the dream before he was called into the king's service.
Yeah. So they pointed the 603 B.C. date is reliable. I was just guesstimating off the top of my head on the 601 date. Page 8. Second year. I was just guessing about when Daniel would have entered the service. And I just was guesstimating, and it was a bad guess.
So
the date, you might have put that in your notes, I don't think it's, I appreciate Mark catching that. The second year of Nebuchadnezzar, 603 BC, is probably, I've got a question about it, on the top of page 8, it's probably correct, because you can date that to the records. At least fairly close to that. The other one, we have no date, and I was just shooting in the hip, guesstimating. So just mark out in your notes that it's not important, it's not critical. Because we're given no exact chronology of what we're doing. I appreciate my attention. Anyone
else?
Any other questions? Any questions? Okay, now we come to the easy chapter. discussing four, and we'll finish this today, which is chapter three. This is one of the first things you learned in Vacation Bible School. Daniel and the three children, the three children in the fiery furnace. And this is good stuff. Now, this, let me say going in, this is one of the things, which I've said this before in other connections, that I really is bad about a lot of primary education. When you get the flannel graph, it used to be the flannel graph, anymore, or the video or whatever they used to do, they did it for visual aids. And you get that in the beginner's department, that picture of the flood and Daniel the lion's den, you know, with the people. You know, so anyway, it's pretty hard to take the biblical account seriously after that. You get the bolderized version of it. But anyway, bolderized version of it, that means, you know what that means, bolderized. I'm not reading that English agent of the Bible. Talking Boulder with the Shakespeare expert in all the dirty parts. What I'm saying is that we must try to forget if we can be. This is one of the stories that we picked on, you know, for a little bit because it's easy to deal with. Sometimes we don't see the real horror of it. And the song kind of, you know, Fourth Man of Fire. What I'm saying is sometimes this is one of the stories in the Bible that's been trivialized. Sometimes in good intention, sometimes frivolously, but we'll try to go with that. Let's begin. Nebuchadnezzar the king had an image of gold, but we don't know exactly when this was. And one of the problems is we're not sure this is the same Nebuchadnezzar. Probably is, the one we've already read about. The thing about it is that Nebuchadnezzar apparently became a throne name. Like Caesar did, and Pharaoh did. Pharaoh became a throne name, and Caesar became a throne name. You understand what I'm saying? So that, and we're kind of, sometimes reading Romans, and you're not sure which Pharaoh in the Old Testament, sometimes which Caesar in the Old Testament. Anyway, that's not important. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits, set up on the plain during the province of Babylon. And then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, that is, all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, all the government officials, all the nobles. Then the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, all peoples, nations, and men of every language." Quite a crowd there. At the moment you hear the sound of the horn, hear these Greeks, and these are Greek instruments I talked about before. When you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, all kinds of music, when they strike up the band, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. You hear the music. Time for church. The services begin. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard all this, what they did, they fell down and worshiped the king. Okay. Let's look at the details out very quickly now. What was the image? Doesn't say. Some say it was in himself. Some say it was one of the Babylonian gods. Some say a non-human symbol of his world empire. Some say it was the image he had dreamed, which I don't think so. Whatever it was, of himself or one of the gods, it represented his rule. That is, he was calling for the reaffirmation of his rule over Babylon. Now, this leads me to believe it was not the original Nebuchadnezzar, because the original Nebuchadnezzar didn't need to do that. It was the later ones that when things were going to fall apart, that he needed this kind of reconfirmation. Okay, you got that, Rick? That's not too important. We don't know exactly what it was. Those are the possibilities. Secondly, the signs. Now,
If you did, it said it was a 90, if these are Babylonian cubits, which is 18 inches, the distance between them, the average man's fingertips and his elbow, really, the Egyptian cubit, I think, was 22 inches. This would be a Babylonian cubit, around 18 inches. So it would be 90 feet high, and the proportions are 60 to 1. Something like a flagpole. A very skinny guy, and tall. Newt, what's his Houston basketball player?
Is it 60 to 1 or 6 to 1?
60.
Because we get a 90 feet high and 9 feet wide, isn't that a tenth?
Be 60 cubits, it's wide and it's six. Width and
by 6 cubits.
And the width, 6 cubits.
That's 1 tenth. Wouldn't that be 6 to 1?
It would be a 10 to 1, or 60 to...
Be 6 to 1, or 10 to 1? No, 60 to
1. 6 to 1.
6 to 1. So that would make it a little more...
Yeah, that's probably a mismatch. You see what he's saying? Yeah, that's probably...
I wasn't
going to type that wrong. Yeah, 6 to 1, not 60 to 1.
Well, that was God made you do that.
That would be 10 to 1.
10 to 1?
6 to 6. 6 to 6 would be 10 to 1.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't.
Well, 60 to 1.
What did it do?
10 to 1.
10 to 1.
10 to 1.
Still, 10 to 1 is very narrow. Understand? And what I'm saying is that the dimensions probably included a pedestal. The Babylonians always did this because they flooded regularly. They always tried to keep the gods' feet dry. Remember the ziggurats? We studied in World Western Civ 1. So probably, we don't know how to answer, but probably there was a pedestal and the god on top of it, and the length and the height included the whole pedestal, most likely. And that would have been commonly for them to do. Now, I'm glad you caught that. It's probably a typo. Young suggested, in the text which we used before, I cited, you don't have it, Edward Young, the text which is now a print, suggested that the pedestal had been discovered in Tol Dura. There's been a pedestal discovered there in the suburbs of Babylon. He suggests this may be the very pedestal upon which it sat. My answer is, that's possible. First, one of the criticisms the liberals make is that satraps is a Persian name. Understand? He says the satraps came in, but this is the Babylonian Empire. The Persians haven't taken over yet. Is this an anachronism? Understand? Something in there too early. Perhaps Dan uses the Persian designation for this often since he was writing during the Persian period. Understand? Since the Persians were in Rome. So that's very likely. That he was simply, and the Bible is full of that, where they will give the present name for it rather than the name it had back then. You see Moses doing this. He gives the names that it had in his day, not the names that it had before the floods there, just in the days of Abraham. The musical instruments and their names reflect ancient Greek influence. What was the purpose of the commandment? Probably more political than religious. And I've already, perhaps the empire was beginning to crumble already. We don't know when this happened. But the point was, he needed to solidify his rule. Now, if you understand that, you understand why it was so important that that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bow down. Why?
They were outsiders.
Not really. Well, that's secondary. What's the primary reason why it'd be very important that these men? These were some of his top men. It would be an act, and if he was having trouble, apparently he was, to have your top men defy you would seriously undermine your authority, would it not? You just can't have that. Okay, verse 8. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They were jealous of these Jews being elevated above them, having such authority over them and wealth. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever, standard greeting. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound about the horn, flute, and so forth, they repeat the decree, to fall down and worship you. If it does not fall, verse 11, if anybody doesn't do it, shall be cast into a furnace of blazing fire. Is that what you said? Yeah, that's the decree. Now, how come, by the way, how come they didn't notice that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how come Nebuchadnezzar didn't notice that they, that these three were missing? The first time they had this, the first worship service. Probably because there were so many there. And he just assumed that they were there. There would be several thousand gathered there. He probably just assumed they were there. There are certain Jews who give a point over the administration of the province of Babylon, and he names them. Their enemies name them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, giving the Babylonian names. These men weren't there. You thought they were there? They weren't there. They did not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you set up. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king, some of them. He responded and said to them, is it true that you did not serve my gods? You weren't there for that service. Now, he said, I'm going to give you another chance. It shows his high regard for these men. Didn't just kill them out of hand. So we're going to give you one more chance. We're going to get the band back together. And we're going to strike up the band one more time. And when you hear the music, then, and you don't fall down and worship. Apparently the music was tied, had some religious significance. It was part of some liturgy, sacred liturgy. You understand, it wasn't just accompaniment. They didn't dance to it. It was just, you know, like recreation. It may have danced religiously. But it was a liturgy. When you hear the proper liturgy, we're gonna have a marshmallow. You will immediately be cast into the furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there to deliver you out of my hands? See, he already suspects, he knows why they didn't do it. Now, if this is the same Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it sound strange that he would give such homage to Daniel's God at one point and then by this time do a turnabout? Now, that doesn't prove it, because that may have been a temporary faith. Temporary sentiment, not faith. This suggests it's not the same Nebuchadnezzar, understand? It's one of his predecessors, one of his descendants wearing the throne name, possibility. Or it could be the same one, the time has passed. And they can certainly change their mind. Ancient rulers did this. They were notorious for this, changing their attitudes as time passed. I like this answer. This is great. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, by the way, where's Daniel?
He's running the country.
He doesn't ever come into this event. He's out of it. And he always, when I say he's always there, he's never around the beginning of these things. Here he doesn't come in at all. How did he avoid this? Probably very wisely. Why didn't the enemies accuse Daniel?
He just must not have been around them to accuse.
Well, it could have been. He was so powerful they were afraid of
him. If that's where you were boys instead of three lesser leaders, see what happened.
Could be that Daniel has fallen into disfavor now and he's out of the picture. Because later on we're going to find that Daniel did fall out of the picture. We're going to have Belshazzar's feast. That is, he has to be reminded, he's not in the middle of things. The number of possibilities. Understand, he may have, they slipped into obscurity or to comparative obscurity. It may just that he'd been on a journey for the kingdom. It may be that he was too powerful to threaten. You just don't know. Okay. I like this answer. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. In other words, it goes without saying what our answer is going to be. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of the blazing fire. He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image you set up. And look at this answer. This is tremendous. He said, he's reading, you see, very wealthy, important men, been running the kingdom, apparently, in some parts of it. He says, look, we're going to start, we're going to play this liturgy, we're going to play this hymn one more time. And you bow down, and everything's okay. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, look, king, you can play that thing for the next 3 weeks. You can play it till the band gets tired and goes on. Or, you know, you can strike up the band or not strike up the band. It doesn't make any difference. We're not going to do it. Save yourself the expense and the time. We're not going to do it. And what if Nebuchadnezzar said, let's see if your God can deliver you. They said, well, we don't know if our God can or not. Whether he does or not, we're not going to bow down. I like that. Now, look what I say in this. So number one, this reflects the spiritual implications of the command, doesn't it? That is, whatever there was about this, they understood that it was a piece of, they would have had to defy God. It would have been heresy for them to bow down. Kind of the early Christians who could not acknowledge that Caesar was Lord. Of the religious implication of it. We're not going to honor these gods. Now when he says, if our God is not able, were they questioning the ability of God? No. Now the common answer is, I put in the syllabus, they were questioning the ethical ability. That is, we don't know if God can do it in terms of his eternal plan, whether it's going to fit into his plan or not. For instance, you see something like this. Could God have rescued Jesus from the cross? Well, yes and no. He could have. Jesus said that. I call the angels and we'll take care of this right now. You want to fight. But he could not and fulfill his eternal plan. It may be, I don't put this in the syllabus, it'll be in the revised version. It may be that neither was the case. They were not questioning God's ability, ethical or metaphysical. They may have just been responding to the king's sneer, that is, answering him in kind. He says, well, in the same, with no theological implication at all. If I decide to throw you in the fiery furnace, you would think your God can deliver you? And they may have just been responding in kind, saying, well, whether he can or not, we're not going to understand. We often talk about this is common, with no implication, whatever, which I kind of think. After I've been in the syllabus, I feel further to reflect on that. That's probably what we're doing, just reflecting his sneer. Well, I like this. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. That's a mild understatement. He was mad at the way in. And his facial expression was altered. It's hard to translate that. That means he was furious. And in this idiom, his facial expression was altered. That's an idiom for his attitude toward them was reversed. Toward, understand, Daniel is not simply saying the king made a face, squinting up his nose. His face was altered. Are you with me? Make you awake. That's a Hebrew, it's a Semitic idiom meaning his attitude toward them changed. Toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated in a regular place of execution. Now, again, is this to be taken literally 7 times? No. In the first place, how do they know 7 times? Again, ancient Semitic idiom. What's he saying? 7 times more than it's been heated before. Not 6, not 8, not 3, 7. As hot as possible. Yeah. As hot as 7. Often those meant what? Completeness? What he's saying, that was again an idiomatic way of saying, just like changing his face meant attitude. It's saying, get that thing as hot as it'll get. Put as much fire in it as you can get in it. My wife's grandfather was a pioneer restoration preacher from the hills of Kentucky. He's the man, by the way, converted back to John Smith. And
that is, brought him to his final decision about obeying the gospel. His name is Asa Maxey. He was the first man to really systematically preach New Testament Christianity in the state of Maine. Anyway,
good choice.
When he grew up back in the hill with as much education, so when he went to the old college of the Bible, he had to get his high school education, his undergraduate education, then went on to Drake University, and got his master's degree in preaching under here. He's a father of all the 90 missionary degree. Anyway, and he got educated. And I never met him, because he was dead when I married Linda, but I knew his grandma, Max, his wife, for years, and she died a few years ago. My kids were little, my Admiral Maxey tells about Mr. Maxey, she still called him. And she'd say how when he really got to preaching, he'd forget his educated grammar and fall back on the grammar of his youth, his upbringing. And it was an interesting mixture, because he was an educated man, but he understand he was raised with this mountain way of speaking. And she said, and she told me about one sermon one time, that he was preaching on this text, on Daniel, on this verse. And he was really getting going. He himself was somewhat heated up. And he felt, and he set back into the language, into the vernacular of his youth. And he said, "And the king decreed that the furnace should be hit 7 times hotter than it was wont to be hit." Well, as if, hit 7 times hotter than it was wont to be hit. Perfectly hot. Now, and he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in the army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the fire, furnace, and blazing. He mentions the clothes. Why? We're going to see it later. He mentions it. Fully clothed. Threw them in. Tied them up and threw them in. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, get some of your bravest men. Why? If these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace fire, still tied up. If you wonder how the configuration of that would be, I've got it for you here. I want no smart remarks about my artwork. Promise? Raise your right hand, Sal. Make fun of Dr. This is what it looked like. I don't have you ever had a picture. You see, there would be a furnace like this. This is a common way of execution. Burn them alive. And the king would sit out here. We're going to see this in a minute. So they could have the joy of watching his enemies die in the fire. So they would have a platform. They would heat it. And they would carry the victims, criminals, up the steps, throw them down in. And then the witnesses would sit out here through this open the side and watch them. Now the reason, and you can see, can you not, why he was so angry at these leaders. Why was he angry? Because the whole purpose of this religious ceremony was to solidify his kingdom, and here were his top men undermining the very thing he was trying to accomplish. So he was so mad, he had extra fire burning, so the fire would come out of the top. Can you imagine that? This tremendous fire, which didn't normally have, coming out of the top. So that it would cover the platform that was not normally engulfed in flames, so that the men, in order to get Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into the pit, they had to carry them, and they had to enter the flames themselves. Think about that. Does that make sense to you? So they had to enter the flames to get them down the hole, and they themselves were killed. Quite a fire. Now, this is, don't take that picture too literally. That's just the schematic, more or less, representation of it. Well, any questions on that? Now, let's go on. So they fell into this and the fire still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste and responded and said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast down into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said, "Yeah, 3. He answered and said, "Look, I see 4 men." You see what I'm saying? It had to be like something like this, because if the fire destroyed the men who put the Hebrew children into the fire furnace, how could the king, he could have climbed the steps and look at him. He himself would be destroyed. So he's over here at the side saying, look, I see four men. There's Nebuchadnezzar, he's waiting. You picture this, boy, he's so furious. He's sitting back on his throne, and I'm watching this, and so badly the men who carry them up or destroy themselves, they're burned to death before they can, you know, carry them and tie that man over to the hole and throw them in and get back. And he's just waiting to see them writhe in the flames. And they go in, and they're walking around, and he's like, you see the candles?
Hey, come here. How many did we throw in there anyway?
I thought there was, weren't there just three?
Yeah. I count four.
And he answered and said, look, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the flame without harm, and the fire without harm. We threw three men tied up, and I see four men. And what are they doing? They're walking around. And the appearance of the fourth is like what? A son of the gods. King James has son of God. That psalm is based on, you know, the fourth man in the fire. They wouldn't bend, they wouldn't bow, they wouldn't burn. The fourth man in the fire was like the son of God. Was, I put the Hebrew, what did he say? Did he say, I see the son of God? Was this Jesus, the pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus in there? I think not. He didn't say, I see the son of God.
He wouldn't have
gone anywhere. Yeah, what he said was, I see a son of the gods. Now, I put the Hebrew radicals in here for you, in case you've got Bar Elohim, that's Aramaic. Anybody, any Hebrew students in here? Yeah, that's not Hebrew, that's Aramaic. It would be Ben Elohim if it were Hebrew. Bar Elohim, and just like Ben Elohim means son of God or son of the God or son of gods, Elohim is plural, masculine plural. Elohim is masculine plural. You can't always tell how to translate it. It can be translated either way. Son of God or son of gods. And just as Elohim and Elohim are used, Elohim is used for the true God, Elohim, and for the pagan gods. And you have to look at the context to tell whether it's which it is. What he's saying is that there's something about the fourth man that was not like the other three. It had the appearance of deity. Why? Its shape, perhaps, size, I think. And maybe I drew it that way. I think it was very large. I don't know. See, there was something about it that you could tell it was not just another man. It was a all he is saying is, it's a deity, it's a god. And that's how he would have said it, the son of the gods.
Necessarily
from
saying that mean that the appearance of it, or couldn't it also mean that,
if
he saw these men walking in there, that it had to be a god?
It's a logical conclusion. I think from the language, there was something about the appearance that this was not, there was not just another man. Something like it, but there was nothing there. Now, who was it in there with him, do you suppose? An angel, I think, probably, most likely an angel. And the angel apparently untied them. And then what are they doing in there? Well, remember the apocryphal additions to Daniel, the Song of the Three? You can see what they were saying, if you read that, what they were singing, living in the fire furnace. Well, let's finish out. Any questions? This is not too complicated. So, then Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the furnace, as near as he could get in the blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, so they could walk out this way. What if I hadn't walked out before? I think I would have angel or no angel. There may have been some kind of gate over it, iron gate blocking the way. If you could see through it, I didn't put that in the picture. He may have said, open the gate and let him out. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out in the midst of the fire. And the satraps, prefects, governors, kings, high officials gathered around Saul in regard to these men, that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even upon them. You can see why he made a special note of knowing the hair of their clothes. They didn't even smell like they'd been to a wind gush. I mean, they just absolutely were protected. See, the complete nature of God doesn't right. They were not even singed. couldn't even smell the fire. Well, think about that. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel or messenger, Melech, you can translate the way, and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and healing up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god." You remember his sneer. And which god can protect you? Why is he getting so humble all of a sudden?
Shut down.
Well, he had just insulted this god, and this god, if I were, he was not stupid. I think it is time to be humble. Because what would he do if the God had gotten out of that protected him and came after him? He would even go ahead and send it out of him. I think it was time to, admit you were wrong. Because therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn down from the land, this is the standard curse, which we looked at before. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon.